Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
This is True Crime Cast. Indeed, I am Jamie, joined by John as always. What's up?
Dude, it's a great time of year, dude. Football's in full swing. Fall is just right around the corner, and we have a pretty crazy story for y'all today. So things are going great. How are you, man?
Yeah, things are pretty good. Kind of the same here, and got a really good case here today. One that I want to learn more about because it's so fascinating.
Yeah. Well, we have some housekeeping to take care of, so you have some ratings and reviews for us today?
I have a couple here. We have Callum Corrigan, who says, amazing show and hands down my number one true crime podcast. Joins Patreon sometime back and listen every week and just finished Left on Dead that I truly loved. Keep up the great work, and I can't wait for more podcasts and hopefully some more like Left on Dead. From your boy across the pond, Callum.
Dude, I love that. Name is definitely familiar to me, so thank you, Callum.
This one comes from WonderJ786, says, hello, found this podcast from Talk is Jericho, been listening for a year and never looked back. Enjoy the way they talk about the case, not going into graphic details as much, but all in all, very great content. I would also like to ask Jamie for any advice about your adoption process you went through. And advice you have for me and my wife on going through the process. Have a blessed day, and thank you for your content. Needs to be 10 out of 10. Wonder J, I love talking about foster care and adoption. Send us an email at truecrimecast@gmail.com, and I'll definitely, we'll figure out a way to communicate, and I'd love to further that conversation. Got another one that came in over on social media. I believe this one was on Facebook. It's Becky Stewart that says, I love True Crime Cast. Jamie and John have great personalities. They give just enough detail without being too gory. There is great banter, and they give well-researched cases. I am addicted. Love you guys. Thanks for working hard. Thanks for all the awesome reviews, guys. These are the most helpful thing you can do for our show, and we are very appreciative of that.
Yeah, I love reading those, and taking the time to read those online or on this show is awesome. So thank you guys again. It means a lot. Before we get into the case, I do want to take a moment to mention that you can binge listen more content by joining Patreon. For as little as $3 a month, you can get bonus episodes each and every month. We have 6 years worth of content over there. We also give these main feed shows to you a day early and ad-free. And, you know, it's just a lot of fun.
Yeah, it is. We try to do as much extra stuff over there as we can, in addition to continuing to providing that content that is extra above and beyond, but also the early ad-free is so underrated.
Yeah.
I think that's super helpful. Anytime I get a chance to listen to something without commercials, I go that direction.
Yeah. It's funny because when I was a consumer, I hated ads. And now as a producer, they keep the bills on.
They keep the lights on. Yeah.
But we love those. But if you want to join Patreon, you can get it early and ad-free.
Yeah, I'm enough housekeeping, enough business. John, go ahead and get us rolling on this fascinating story.
We're going to take a little trip to Illinois. We're going to go to Starved Rock State Park. It's a lovely wilderness area on the Illinois River. It is most well known for its steep sandstone canyons that are formed by glacier meltwater and beautiful waterfalls. I mean, I don't know. When I think of Illinois, of course you think Chicago, but that's only one small part of the state, right?
The rest of it is
beautiful. But this gorgeous park has some pretty violent past, like some past violence happened in this park. First off, the park's name itself comes from a rock fortress along the Illinois River, where at one time a band of Native Americans were under attack in the 17th century. So as this attack continued, this was not something that happened just in the course of a few hours. This happened for a long time when they were under attack, and the tribe numbers started to decrease because of starvation, and that is why it's called Starved Rock.
Fast forward to March of 1960. Three women decided to go out for a trip. It was time for them to get away, to to enjoy each other. They lived in Chicago, but they wanted to go out, do some bird watching, do some hiking, and they chose Starved Rock Park as their destination. This was 47-year-old Francis Murphy, 50-year-old Mildred Lindquist, and 50-year-old Lillian Edding. And they were all wives of prominent Chicago businessmen, but no matter where you live, I feel like you need a change of scenery every now and then. If you live in Chicago and live in the city, it's great to get out in the wilderness. We live kind of out in the country, so I like going to a big city every now and then.
We went to Atlanta a few weeks ago, and it was just so much different.
Yeah, fun to mix it up. All three of these people were friends, and they went to church together at the Riverside Presbyterian Church, and they were so pumped for this. They've been planning it for a long time.
I know I have a group of friends that I used to do outings with, and you look forward to it because you get to catch up, you get to take a break away from reality and out of your normal work routine or whatever. It's just a fun time. So I can imagine how excited they were.
And Lillian especially, she had spent all winter taking care of her husband. He had had a heart attack, and he needed pretty attentive care. So she spent the whole winter really paying all of her attention to him and taking care of him. He was finally on the mend, and this was her chance to get out and hike, birdwatch, and just be outdoors and do something for yourself for a change.
I can really relate to Lillian. I love bird watching. I know that sounds like such a papaw thing to say.
I've seen you do it.
It is just being outdoors, watching birds, just really, I don't know, takes the edge off all the craziness in life. So they arrived at the Starved Rock Lodge on Monday, March 14th, 1960. And employees at the lodge said Frances parked her gray station wagon in the inn's parking area, and the women unloaded a few pieces of luggage. They went in, and like you always do, you register for your rooms. They got two rooms. They dropped off their bags, and they ate some lunch in the lodge's dining room. And they told one of the staff members that it was a beautiful day for a hike as they left carrying a camera and a small pair of binoculars. So the friends left the inn wearing rubber galoshes. So kind of like you're expecting a storm kind of shoe. You don't expect to be doing like rigorous hiking. Like you're going to be doing mountain climbing or like rock climbing in those shoes. But the path they followed was covered in light snow. So they trudged and slipped along. They paused to take photos of the scenery and of one another. And eventually the three came to the dead end of the St. Louis Canyon, where there was a gorgeous frozen waterfall. And this was only a mile from the lodge.
Yeah, you say only a mile, and when you're hiking, a mile's really not that far, but if you're in the snow and you've been slipping the whole time, a lot of times it can feel like you're far away.
Walking in the snow is rough, and this is like much bigger snow than we have in Kentucky.
The first sign that something was wrong was that night when Lillian's husband George tried to call. She had told him that when she got there and got settled, she would call to check on him. But she hadn't. So George started to get worried. Now, this is 1960s. It's not like she has a phone. He can't check her location. I think even when we were growing up, if somebody says they're going to call you, there's a lot more leeway that goes into that than there would be now when everybody has a phone in their pocket.
Right.
George called the lodge, and the staff told him that his wife was not available, but that she had checked in. They told George they had gone out and suggested that he call back in the morning. They had been out, and maybe they were already in bed. So the next morning, George gets up and calls the lodge again and asks to speak to his wife. Now, at this point is a really crucial detail that really puts everybody behind on investigating what is to come. But the staff member that answered the phone mistakenly told George that the three women had been at breakfast that morning and they had gone out for the day. He said, "Yes, I saw them. They were here." When that was in fact not the case. So George felt better. Somebody had eyes on her. She was alive and well. So he hung up.
So Tuesday night, March 15th, 1960, there was a late winter storm that hit the Illinois Valley, and the storm dropped nearly a foot of snow on the area. This is kind of normal for up there, but down here, that would just shut us down for a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
It was near like blizzard conditions, and it made the roads in the park impassable. It was just a lot of snow in a short amount of time.
Yeah, and I think if you know that's happening where a loved one is, you do start to worry a little bit. So George called again. This time, his wife and her friends still could not be reached. At this point, he really started to worry. "Yeah, I know you saw her, but I haven't spoken to her myself, so why don't you go to their room, check on them, and report back to me. Just let me know that they were not impacted by this storm and they are, in fact, okay. When they went into the room, they saw that the beds had not been slept in, the bags had not been unpacked. They quickly checked the parking lot and found that Francis's station wagon was still there, and it was completely covered in snow. It hadn't been moved since they initially arrived. So George and the staff realized that the women had now been missing for 48 hours. They, in fact, were not at breakfast that morning. They had not been seen since they checked in and went out for that initial hike, so panic sets in for everybody.
George had a pretty interesting connection, so he hung up the phone, and then he called one of his longtime friends named Virgil Peterson. Virgil was the operating director for the Chicago Crime Commission, and when Virgil heard the news, he contacted the state police and other law enforcement agencies in the area, and really within minutes of this call, the sheriff's office heard about it and immediately organized the search party to help look for the women. But as you mentioned earlier, Jamie, we're over 40 hours behind at this point.
And usually the first 24 hours are critical. The first 48 hours are huge. If you haven't found anything or at least started looking there, you are definitely behind any time that somebody's missing. And this is a really quick response from the police department. We usually don't see this, especially when it's a missing person. But Bill Danley was a local newspaper reporter, and he was finishing up his last story of the day when he heard wind of the missing women up at the lodge. So he grabbed his camera, got his snow boots on, braved through the treacherous roads, and headed up towards Starved Rock Park. When he got to the park, he noticed that there was a young boy running toward the road. So Bill decided to follow him to a parking area where he found that there were other kids. They were shouting that they had found bodies on a nearby trail. Bill knew these boys, and he pulled them aside to ask them some questions about what they had found, and they told him that they had found three bodies, what condition they were in, and obviously these were bodies of passed away individuals. Bill called the lodge where the officers were, and then called the newspaper to report the story. So I like his order of operations there: call authorities and then do my job. And in minutes, the story was the top headline, not only in Chicago, but all around the country. And authorities started immediately going from a missing persons investigation to a murder investigation.
So let's go to the crime scene. When they get there, they see three women that had been brutally beaten, and they were inside of a cave at the canyon of the Starved Rock State Park. Now, they were lying side by side on their backs, and they were partially covered with snow. And their lower clothing had been torn away and their legs had been spread open. So this looks like not only a murder, but some kind of sexual trauma as well. Their lower clothing, like I said, was torn open. They each had severe head trauma, and two of the bodies were tied together with heavy twine. They were covered with blood and their legs were black with bruises. And state police in that scene searched the immediate area, but they really couldn't search around the cave because everything was covered in more than 6 inches to a foot of snow that had come down since the time of their murders. So they were really only able to search the floor of the overhang where the bodies were found.
And you know, they had been missing since before the big snowfall happened. So any evidence was under the snow. It's not like they can track footprints or a blood trail based on the surface. Anything they needed to know was 6 to 12 inches underneath the surface. Police used torches to try to melt away the snow to uncover more details about the crime scene. And what they found was this was the scene of a violent struggle. Francis's camera was found 10 feet away from them. The strap had been broken and the whole thing was just covered in blood. They also discovered the women's binoculars, also covered in blood. Not far from the bodies, LaSalle County State Attorney Harlan Warren found a frozen tree limb with blood all over it, and the snow under it was covered in blood. So the investigators assumed that this tree limb, essentially a small log that was small enough to pick up, was used as the murder weapon.
So as more of the scene was visible, authorities started to believe that the women were killed deeper in the canyon and then dragged and positioned under the rock ledge. Eventually, the women's bodies were removed from the scene. They were removed on cloth stretchers. You've seen those on like TV shows. We don't use those anymore. And they were examined and autopsied for further explanation and evidence. This proved difficult because since the women had been outside in a blizzard, and since it was 1960, technology was not as advanced as it is today. They found no evidence of rape. They were able to determine a time of death, and they said that it happened shortly after the women enjoyed their lunch at the lodge. And there didn't appear to be a motive, so many wondered if it was a robbery gone wrong, but the women's watches and jewelry was not taken. And dude, I mean, I know we try to avoid a lot of the gore, but why would their bottom halves be ripped off and bruised if this was not some kind of sexual motivation?
Right. That's a great question, and a question I think that may have still gone unanswered. And they were hit so brutally. There was over 100 blows given, whether it was from the log, whether it was from hands. They were hit over 100 times. It almost makes it seem personal, but there seems to be nobody they know up at the lodge or up at Starved Rock Park. So we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll dive into the investigation and talk about how they narrowed in on a suspect for these murders. The investigation into the murder of these three women was really surrounded by jurisdictional problems and drama. Technically, the state's attorney, Warren, that I mentioned earlier, was in charge of this, but the state police wanted authority on the case since they were committed at a state park. These two groups clashed and argued about who would lead the investigation, and eventually Warren gave in and gave the state police jurisdiction to come in since LaSalle County officers had next to no experience dealing with homicides, and that was pretty obvious based on how they handled the scene. As time went on, newspapers and radio broadcasts reported just how slow this investigation was going. Again, they didn't even start the investigation until almost 2 days after the woman had disappeared. This made for a panicked community. For all they knew, there was a killer on the loose that could put everybody else in that area in danger. Harlan Williams would admit that he's not a detective, but he decided to look over the case one more time. He went to see if the killer had left behind anything when it dawned on him. The twine was the one piece of evidence that was taken to the crime scene and left there. It was not native to the area. The branch could have been picked up anywhere. Lauren took it upon himself to go and get a microscope and to look at this twine to see if he could figure out where it came from. Now, we're using this word twine. Twine is basically, if rope married a string, their kids will be twine. It's not as strong as a rope, but it is woven together strings, right?
Yeah, it's used to like hold multiple things together, but not like as big as a rope.
There were two different types of twine that were used, and there was a 20-ply cord and a 12-ply one. Now, this was the best lead they had, so he grabbed two local deputies and decided that they were going to help him to follow up on this lead, which was really the only thing they had going at the time.
So these two started their search at the last place the ladies were seen alive, and that was back at the Starved Rock Lodge. And it didn't take long for the men to search the kitchen, and when they did, they found both kinds of twine that were used in the murder. So they were used for wrapping up food, like how it came, I guess, shipped to them or whatever. But the two decided that they would track down the twine's manufacturer and assess that the twine in the murders definitely came from the kitchen of the Starved Rock Lodge. So how awesome is it that even in the 60s, this guy buys a freaking microscope and is able to track down where this twine came from, and it came from the lodge itself. That's awesome police work.
That's huge. Yeah, it's made such a big impact. If he hadn't done this, how long would it have taken them to come around and find that themselves?
I guess, I mean, I've never been a detective, but the more you can narrow down your suspects, of course, the better, right?
Yeah.
This wasn't just somebody random that happened to be in the park that lived God knows where. It's very likely that the killer either worked at or had access to the park's lodge. So that really helps narrow down your suspect list. But the problem is that all of the lodge employees had been given polygraph tests and passed. I know you don't love polygraph tests.
Sure don't.
But I feel like it would help you even more narrow down your suspect list, but they don't have any, you know, nothing comes from this test. But Warren decided to hire a specialist from Chicago and recall all the employees that worked the week of the murder. And that included a man named Chester Wager.
Chester Otto Wager was born on March 3rd of 1939 in Derby, Iowa, to his parents Herschel and Juanita Wager. When Chester was just 2 years old, his family moved to Illinois. His dad worked as a painter. His mom was a housekeeper there at the Starved Rock Lodge. So he had a long history with the lodge. He had five sisters, and the large family lived in a two-bedroom house just outside of town. Chester went on to get married and have two children of his own, Rebecca and John. And at the time of the murders, Chester was 21 years old, and he had been working as a dishwasher at Starved Rock Lodge. He was a small man. He was a military veteran, and he recently quit his job at the lodge to go and paint with his dad. So he was there at the time of the murders. He was part of that initial wave of individuals that were screened and given polygraph exams. But then he quit his job and went to work for his dad, which I don't find to be suspicious at all on the surface.
Yeah, Chester was questioned in the days following the murder and then again a month later. And he testified that at the time of the murder, he was on a break in a room at the lodge by himself. I'm just going to stop there. I mean, how do you really know that? You don't have a phone record to say, oh, I was on TikTok at this time, or I was making a phone call.
Well, I think this is what he told him. And anytime your alibi is, I was alone, it's not great. Even if you are alone, it looks bad.
And maybe, I don't know, maybe if they said these murders took place at 9:50, where were you at 9:50? And then he could say, well, that's the time I take my break every single day.
Yeah.
Other than that, I don't know how you in your mind could actually recall that. If I am ever arrested for a murder that I didn't commit, I'm going to be terrible. I'm like, I don't know.
Well, this is a month later. Tell me where you were exactly a month ago at 1:15.
Yeah. And I would have to look at my calendar and just pray that I was, you know, had something
documented it. Yeah.
Otherwise there's a really good chance I'm on my couch watching TikTok.
I will say that this day was a big day for everybody at the lodge. So it is a little more ingrained in everybody's memory, but you're right. It's why when it's eyewitness testimony and any kind of witness is a little less reliable than we would like to hope.
He did, like I said, pass all his polygraph tests during these interrogations. Chester always happily cooperated with investigators, would answer questions. Chester willingly surrendered a piece of his buckskin jacket with quote unquote dark stains on it for an examination. It later turned out that those dark stains would be human blood. But in 1960, they couldn't be tested for DNA. So you don't know if this was blood that he may have got on him in the kitchen while prepping meat, or if this was his blood or the blood of one of the victims. In late September 1960, which would be 6 months after the murder, Dummett picked up Chester to take him to see a specialist in Chicago for yet another polygraph test. Chester was interrogated all day by the detective, and the detective claimed that Chester failed the polygraph test this time. He spent the rest of the day trying to get Chester to admit that he was guilty, but Chester continued to claim that he was in fact innocent. Now, the detective allegedly threatened Chester, and he said that if he didn't sign a confession, he would be sentenced to the electric chair. And how many times have we talked about forced confessions? And keep in mind, this is something that he had been through like a couple times before, but now this interrogation is happening somewhere he's not familiar with, and it's lasting all day long.
Yeah, he was there for at least 12 hours, and I don't think the Reed technique was invented before that time, but this is a lot of the techniques that police use today. Now, that detective's name was Dummett, his partner's name was Hess, and they were the ones in charge helping Warren with this investigation. Looking back at the jacket, once it was determined that it was human blood, Warren decided it had to be this guy. So he put Chester under constant surveillance by the state police. I know we couldn't do DNA testing in the 60s, John, but couldn't we tell blood types back then? And in all of my research, I couldn't find that mentioned at all. So couldn't we say the blood was a mixture of B positive and O negative and then match that to the women?
I don't know. Could they do that back then?
I would think so, but maybe I'm wrong.
I don't know. I'd have to Google like when blood transfusions became a thing, but yeah. I'm kind of like you. You would think that even in the 60s, I mean, we put a freaking man on the moon.
I mean, that was a well-known thing as I grew up in the 80s. So I assume that it existed in the 60s because there wasn't as much technological advancement between the 60s and 80s as there was from like 2000 to 2020.
Right.
Regardless, Dummett has continued to look into Chester's background and they find that he did have a violent past. About a mile from where these women's bodies were discovered back in 1959, there was a reported robbery that also included rape. So Dummett found the victim of that crime and showed her a stack of mugshots of individuals that could have potentially attacked her because that was an unsolved crime as well. So he asked her to pick the attacker out of that list of mugshots, essentially a photo lineup, and allegedly she sorted through them and screamed when she got to Chester's photo and said, that's the man that raped me.
So they put Chester under constant surveillance, and that lasted about a month until he was picked up for one more round of questioning, and that would take place on November 16th, 1960. Chester was interrogated again for hours and always maintained his innocence. Later that night, despite there being no physical evidence linked to Chester, there were no witnesses, and Chester had not confessed to anything, they still used an arrest warrant to go pick up Chester. Now, he was picked up, and he was told again that if he did not confess, then he would be sentenced to the electric chair. And they kept him in an interrogation room until past midnight. They questioned him for more than 24 hours. And once Chester was nearly exhausted, he stopped mid-sentence and simply asked to see his family. Now, when he did that, they sent a police car, and they picked up his parents and brought his mother and father in for a few moments alone with their son. And shortly before 2 a.m. on November 17, 1960, Chester gave Detective Dummett a confession.
And he really just blurted it out. And this is the quote from notes of that interrogation. "All right, I did it. I got scared. I tried to grab their pocketbook. They fought and I hit them." Now, a pocketbook is the same as a purse, in case you didn't grow up in an area that called it that. So it's a smaller purse. And police thought, well, maybe he was talking about the bag that Francis's camera was kept in. Minutes later, his full confession was transcribed, and he was asked to sign that, and Chester did so. During this confession, Chester was asked why he ended up putting the bodies under the overhang in the canyon. He said that he had spotted a small airplane flying low over the park, so he was doing this to make sure that they didn't see the bodies. He was afraid of getting in trouble and panicked, so he thought this would hide them for a while, for enough time for him to clear the scene. A few days later, the flight over the park was confirmed by the pilot's logbook. So here Chester is putting himself in the woods that day, saying there was a plane. There was indeed a plane. Chester would later go on to say that he was fed all of this information from detectives, including the bit about the plane. And since Dummett was a member of the local flying club, that kind of made sense. He's now claiming that his confession was coerced. He was fed the information. He's innocent. And, you know, it makes it hard to decide. Dummett was very involved in the local airplane scene, if you want to call it that. So this is tough to hear Chester going back and forth.
So days after Chester was appointed a public defender, he recanted his entire confession. He said that he was made to be, I don't know, he was under duress after being threatened by the interrogators. A grand jury returned indictments against Chester for all three murders, but the state chose only to try him for the murder of Lillian. Why would that be, dude?
So they did this because if something went wrong in the trial, if there was a hung jury, if the charges got dropped, if they found him not guilty of this murder, they could still go back and charge him with the others if they got more evidence. They could learn from this trial to convict him later on. And honestly, I feel like this is a way around double jeopardy laws. I don't know what the Supreme Court would think about this, but I'm surprised that if it's allowed, that it's not done more often in the case where there are multiple victims.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. And that's, I don't know, it is a loophole. But if I side with detectives, I mean, that's pretty smart.
I agree. It's a great tactic. if allowed and not seen as a loophole and called out as such. Chester's trial began on January 20th of 1961, and this was the trial not starting till then was tough because Chester was not arrested for a long time after these murders, even after they had identified him as the suspect. And part of that was state's attorney Warren didn't want to arrest Chester because he was running for re-election. He was worried that if he arrested Chester, that it would be looked at as just a move to try to gain popularity for the vote. So he purposefully waited till after the election to arrest him because he didn't want it to look like it was a campaign stunt. However, he lost re-election mostly because he hasn't arrested anybody for this crime, which is kind of a twist. So the new state's attorney, Robert Richardson and Anthony Recuglia, were the prosecutors on the case. They were seeking the death penalty for Chester if found guilty of the murder of Lillian Edding. They relied heavily on circumstantial evidence, obviously, and their confession. If you put those two things together, it paints a pretty good picture of Chester's guilt. But the defense would argue that the confession was coerced, made under duress, and that Chester was actually getting a haircut and did have an alibi at the time of the murders. Plus, they had the FBI examine the buckskin jacket, and the results were inconclusive as to whether it was human blood or animal blood. So they're bringing in an expert to say it may not have even been human. So we couldn't tell much about blood back then.
We were hoping to get the type of blood. Well, they couldn't even figure out if it was human or animal. Yeah. So
they're just sniffing it, and they're like, well, it's not paint.
On March 4th, 1961, the jury found Chester guilty. So on his 22nd birthday, he was sentenced to life in prison, and he was sent to the Statesville Penitentiary there in Illinois. He appealed his case like you would expect many, many times, but with no success. In 1972, he began attending parole hearings, and then he was denied each time. Dude, he was denied over 24 times. That has to be, I don't know. I mean, it makes me think of Shawshank when it's just a formality. At first, you're eager and anxious because there's a possibility you could get out. But after the first several are denied, it just has to be something you do and don't get your hopes up anymore.
Yeah, you have to lose all hope. And there was some controversy, I guess, around that sentence. It said that the jury didn't know that he would be eligible for parole. They thought they were giving him a life sentence without the possibility of parole, but ended up messing it up. But that was what was dictated, so that stayed in place.
Yep. He eventually became the longest serving inmate in the state of Illinois. And in all that time, he always maintained his innocence.
A lot of people believe Chester is absolutely guilty, but there are other people that really don't believe it. There are several parts of the story that cast doubt about Chester's involvement. For one, there's no physical evidence linking him to the crime. But that's not to say that there's no physical evidence at all at the scene. Frances Murphy had 7 blonde hairs on her body. These hairs were examined and found to be dissimilar to samples taken from Chester. Anytime you're trying to look at a group of suspects, yes, you're trying to figure out, I want to know which one did it. But a great way to do that is to exclude people. And usually evidence like this hair evidence would exclude somebody. So this hair was found on Francis. It didn't belong to her, either of the other two women, or Chester. Lillian Edding had 18 hairs found in the palm of her hand. So it seemed that she was pulling those hairs out and trying to fight for her life. These were black hairs, but Chester's hair wasn't black. The two sets of hair strongly support the theory that this was done by maybe more than one person. And that's a really popular theory for a lot of reasons. First of all, I mentioned that he was small. He was about 5'8". He was skinny, 21-year-old guy. And these aren't like elderly women. They're in their late 40s, early 50s, and there are 3 of them. So could a small guy really overpower these 3 women? And then he would have to drag all their bodies up to that cave in the canyon. Is he really strong enough to do that? A lot of it didn't make sense to many people who followed the case. Chester also claimed his motive was robbery in his initial confession. But like you mentioned about the scene, when the bodies were found, they had all their jewelry, their watches, and the camera was all still left behind, so no robbery seemed to take place.
Yeah, I mean, is it possible? Yeah, I think it is possible. but it just seems like a lot, right?
Is there reasonable doubt? I'm getting there.
In 1982, there was an alleged deathbed confession that was from an anonymous woman in a Chicago hospital, and it was documented in an affidavit that resurfaced back in 2006. Sergeant Mark Gibson said that he went to the hospital to help the woman, quote-unquote, clear her conscience. So I guess she had something to say and called in the police to say it. And when he got there, the woman told her that things got out of hand at a state park and they dragged the bodies. Then the confession was cut short by the woman's daughter, who said their mother was just not of sound mind. She was speaking out of her head and it wasn't legit.
Yeah, deathbed confessions are tricky because you think, yes, this is when people are going to try to clear their conscience or try to get things off their chest. But at the same time, they're not always reliable. There are several people that confess to the same crime on their deathbed, and it's just hard to tell. There was another guy that was high on people's suspect list, and that was the owner of Starred Rock Lodge, George Spiros. Spiros had a reputation for harassing women. It was reported that he enjoyed kind of making women scared and intimidating them. There was a former employee who's a part of the Free Chester Committee, says that Spiro would watch her and sexually harass her in her time working at the lodge. She also remembered a time when Spiros trapped her in a cabin at the lodge with his large barking dogs and just kind of took enjoyment at her fear. This employee says that she thinks he may have used the dogs to corner the women and attack them, since there were allegedly, once the snow started to melt, there were some paw prints in the area, but that's...
You would expect that at a park.
Yeah, it's really hard to tie those back to those dogs. And he was initially looked at, but never charged. Then in 2005, Chester's public defender, Donna Kelly, filed a clemency hearing request where she cast suspicion on Spiros. 2 weeks later, Spiros was found dead in his Starved Rock residence at the age of 73. It was an alleged self-inflicted gunshot wound to the head, and his dog had also been shot. So shortly after his guilt is brought up, potential guilt is brought up in court, he seemed to kill himself. And while that's suspicious, his family said that, you know, he had been diagnosed with cancer and he was going through a lot at the time, and it may have had nothing to do with the court proceedings, but he wanted to avoid the suffering of cancer, and that's why he took his own life.
Man, that is weird timing though, right? But Chester never stopped maintaining his innocence, and he was constantly denied parole for decades. On November 29th, 2018, he was short by only one vote. But the next year, November 21st, 2019, the same board voted 9-4 to grant Chester his release after he had served 59 years in prison. And at the time of his release, Chester was the second longest serving inmate in Illinois, having served 61 years in prison.
On August 1st of 2022, the results from hair evidence came back from the lab. One of the hairs found in Francis Murphy's glove is that of a man, and the DNA did not match Chester. Today, Chester's and attorneys don't know who the hair belongs to, but it's been submitted to a DNA databank in hopes of finding a match and finding the real killer. He's out, but he's still fighting with his attorneys to prove his actual innocence.
Dude, isn't it wild? I mean, he was, what, 22 years old when he was arrested?
Yeah.
Is that right? And he served 6 decades in prison. I mean, that's your whole life.
A lifetime. Absolutely.
Your whole life. And I don't know. We can speculate more in a moment on whether or not we think he was involved or guilty or not. But if he wasn't, and you spent your whole life in there, that's more tragic.
And it happens more often than we'd like to think.
His legal team, which was led by attorney Andy Hale, continues to fight for Chester's exoneration. They're asking a judge to consider, among other things, this DNA test. They also claim that they have expert testimony that the log prosecutors was used in the killing didn't actually come from that area. They claim it's more likely the women were killed by weapons like a baseball bat or a tire iron. The team also say that they have interviews with people who said that the now dead mobsters confided in them that they were actually involved in the killings. So, like, confessions from mobsters, you know? I don't know.
I don't know what the mobsters would want with these three women.
That seems far-fetched unless their husbands were involved in something they shouldn't have been.
Yeah.
Because they were businessmen in Chicago.
Yeah.
One of the mobsters allegedly talked about putting his bloody clothes in his car, driving to another county, and then burning the evidence. An Illinois State Police report said that a telephone operator was interviewed claiming that she had overheard a conversation shortly after the killings between two men discussing the disposal of bloody clothes.
Family members of the victims have not been pleased with everything coming back up and with new allegations, and even with Chester being out of prison. A granddaughter, Frances Murphy, calls this move, quote, a desperate act by man in search of money, conveniently preying upon the deaths of all involved. Public fascination with these tragic murders has led to many outlandish theories. Attorney Hale offers no new evidence, instead offering only one such outlandish theory. A granddaughter of Lillian Edding says, Hale is demonstrating nothing more than despicable desperation with an extra dose of cruelty to the memory and legacy of three lovely women who were the victims of a horrible crime. Today, Chester Wegger is 84 years old and continues seeking to prove his innocence of this crime. John, did Chester do it? A. B. Should he have been convicted for it? And then I guess C is an optional question of, if not him, then who?
Yeah. I don't know. Interesting, dude. So Chester's out of jail. He had children before going to prison. So now he has children, grandchildren that he's been able to reunite with. So he has a lot to fight for. And I would imagine, this is just me speculating, you can say it's tacky if you want to, but you know, if he can be proven innocent, or at least that he was wrongly convicted, I'm sure he's entitled to a settlement, which would benefit his children and grandchildren, which
right.
would be great, you know, but I almost tend to think that Chester could have been involved. I mean, the issue with the twine being at the scene, look, all of this almost in my mind is circumstantial evidence. So I'd like to see something more physical to put him there at the scene, but I don't have enough to say he definitely didn't do it, or maybe he had other folks with him, but I don't know.
Yeah,
do you think the DNA and all that is enough to exclude him?
No, not yet. And a lot of it couldn't be tested because it was so old, it had aged and wasn't able to be used. So I don't know that science is the way we're going to get to the bottom of this one. Like you, I don't think there's enough to convince me that he didn't do it, but the standard of proof in American law is not convince me he didn't, it's convince me he did, which also hasn't happened. I think there's absolutely reasonable doubt here and that he shouldn't have been convicted based on what we know. I do think that he is a good suspect and could possibly have done it, but he should not have spent his entire life in prison based on the information that we have here.
Do you feel like, you know, I'm sure a large part of the trial was looking at his past, and he has a former, you know, pretty violent past as far as molestation and rape. Do you feel like the testimony from his rape victim was legitimate or coerced? What do you think about that?
I mean, by all accounts, her testimony was genuine, and he may have committed that crime. However,
that doesn't
make you a murderer, and that doesn't apply to this case. And there was no physical evidence that a sexual assault took place in this case. So if you're looking just for an MO, even though, like you said, the pants were pulled down, so it seems like there would have been some type of assault. We don't have any evidence of that. So this doesn't match the MO of the other rape that it seems like he probably did.
Yeah. You know, this is a tough one. I think where I'm going to land on this is I don't know.
And I wish we haven't had an iffy one like this in a long time.
Yeah. It's one that, you know, there are three women's lives who were ended abruptly and justice needs to be served. But I don't think just throwing the wrong man in prison is justice. That's in fact an injustice, because now you've ruined someone else's life and their family's lives. So you need to have the right people or person responsible. held accountable. And there is doubt in my mind as to whether or not they have the right guy or the only guy.
And I totally get that the families of the women are not happy with this all being brought back up. They have, in their minds, closed this and believe they know who killed their loved one. So I totally get them being upset by that. At the same time, I do think it's prudent to get the right guy, get the right person. And if that ends up happening, then I think we'll all be more thankful and better off for it. But it is a painful process. It's really a no-win situation to be the family of a victim, because you think you got the right person, you want to have the right person, but you don't want to bring it up all the time looking for a new person.
Yep. All right, man. That's going to do it for this case. Guys, let us know what you think. Did they get the right guy? Was it case closed, or is there more to the story?
Yeah, we'd love to hear your feedback. You can find us over on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, or X, formerly known as Twitter.
I'm still not getting used to that. You can also binge listen more episodes on patreon.com if you've already listened to everything else that we have to offer. We have over 6 years worth of content over on Patreon, and we release these regular ads or these regular shows ad-free and a day early.
Be back with another episode of True Crime to go on Friday, guys. Thank you.
Until next crime, this has been True Crime Cast.
You've listened to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.